Hello and welcome back to the Ear Fuel Podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can follow me on Twitter at GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru. The podcast is always available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Ear Fuel and at GetEarFuel.com. This week is the final part in my series on vinyl, and I'm going to be discussing all the ins and outs of buying a new stereo system or upgrading what you already have. I'm going to break down all the different terms for each piece, tell you some of my favorite and least favorite brands. So by the end of this podcast, you'll be ready to buy what you need to rock the walls. But before that, a very quick album review. The album I want to look at today is the brand new release from Dinosaur Jr. Woohoo! And it's called Give a Glimpse of What You're Not. Now, it goes without saying that their 1988 record, Bug, remains a true classic. Oh, that record is so good. And I myself am a massive fan of their 2007 and 2009 releases, Beyond and Farm. To be perfectly honest, I actually think those two more recent records are the best they've ever made. I know some people are going to say that's a bit blasphemous, but it's also true. They were absolutely extraordinary on those records. Anyway, this new record starts off, as a number of the songs on this album do, with a solid lead guitar riff. But, you know, this is a Dinosaur Jr. album we're talking about here, so without insanely great riffs, it's not really Dinosaur Jr., is it? The opening track has a feel to it that's a bit more pop rock leaning than I tend to like from Dino J, and it's quickly clear that this album is very much a continuation of the sound from their 2012 record, I Bet on Sky, which I wasn't a huge fan of. But this is Jay Maskus and crew we're talking about here, so many listens from beginning to end are absolutely necessary before drawing any judgment. Sometimes with this band, you need a bit longer to get what they're going for. But that wasn't the case here. This was a very disappointing album on nearly every front. First and foremost, the mix on nearly every song is atrocious. The drum sound is outright terrible, and the snare just, oh, it's the worst. And it's also placed way too far in front of the mix on almost every song. This is a complete amateur mistake, and with how meticulous they usually are about sound, I was shocked that this is how the final mix came out. Adding to that, the guitars are way too clean. I mean, this is Dinosaur freaking Junior. They're also buried in the mix on most of the songs, and I'm wondering if maybe the engineers got the drum and guitar faders confused. I could not believe this happened. Adding to that, Jay Maskus' vocals are awkwardly placed in the mix, and they're completely separated from the rest of the sound, and it just comes off as disjointed. I cannot overstate how disappointing the production on this album is, and it gets in the way of the actual music. Now, seeing that Jay himself produces damn near everything they do, it just makes things more confusing. Sadly, though, even without these glaring issues, the songs themselves are just not that great. Most of them kick off with a solid riff, and then they just sort of simmer, never reaching anything worth hearing. A number of songs on this record sound unfinished, others sound like Jay's solo album material, and overall it just sounds like the band were holding back for some reason. I hate saying negative things about Dinosaur Jr. as they're one of my favorite bands, but you can't change reality either, and I don't know, maybe the title of this record is meant to be ironic, and the subpar performance is some cruel peek into what the band would sound like in some other reality. I don't know. It's just disappointing, so I'm going to go crank up Beyond and Farm and wash this record out of my ears. Moving on, today we'll conclude our four-part series on the world of vinyl. We've discussed the history of vinyl going all the way back to the 1800s, spent time considering the analog versus digital debate, and even gotten into my habits and why people dig vinyl so much. But there's still one massive stone we've yet to look under, and that's how to best go about buying or upgrading your stereo system. Before we get into any of that, though, I know a number of you are thinking something along the lines of, well, why would I want to get a stereo or upgrade what I have? I get it. You've got your Bluetooth speaker that can go anywhere, or you've got your awesome headphones, or you really never listen to music away from your laptop, so you don't need some rockin' blow-out-the-window system. I get it. Really. But a stereo system isn't about raising the volume of what you're listening to. It's about raising the quality and the quality of the experience. You can have immaculate vinyl made on all the best equipment, but if your playout system sucks, well, it can really ruin the listening experience. I mean, I'm not saying you need a $10,000 stereo to properly appreciate Pink Floyd's Animals album or the most recent Massive Attack single, but like we discussed the other week in Analog versus Digital, music is made to be heard on proper systems. Letting all of those frequencies breathe is what it's all about, so I can't say enough how much better music is on a real stereo system. Oh, and it's much easier then to experience music with friends when you have a stereo. And music with friends is kind of what it's all about. Really, we've spent the last few episodes discussing just how unique and awesome vinyl is, and a great record player is the centerpiece of any great stereo system. So I'm hoping this how-to style podcast will aid you in enjoying music to an even greater extent. What I'm going to cover is basically a way to arm yourself with all the knowledge you need for stereo equipment, you know, what all the specs and terms and all that stuff means, as well as some brands to avoid and some that I love, so that in the end, you've got everything you need to go get yourself a great system. With that out of the way, let's get one other thing out in the open. Stereo systems can be ridiculously expensive, but they don't have to be. You can get a fantastic audio experience without breaking the bank, and what I'm going to discuss today can be applied at any price range. So I think one of the biggest obstacles people experience in buying a new stereo system is where to start. I mean, I know there are so many different styles and components, and it can feel like you need to be an all-out audiophile just to get a good setup, but that's completely false. Buying a stereo is actually very simple, and with things like the internet, you can buy it with more ease and, more importantly, more confidence than ever before. But let's start with what I see as the most important element in the entire stereo upgrade journey. That's right, the budget. I know this may seem like a no-brainer, but you honestly can't do anything at all, even considering what's out there, until you have a budget. I mean, now that I think about it, the first question might actually be that of what are you going to be spending money on? I mean, we all know and use the term stereo, but what does it consist of? Well, there's sort of two approaches here. There's all-in-one systems, and then there's the piecemeal approach. This can have a huge impact on the cost, so it's worth considering both options. Regardless of which approach you take, there are basically three, maybe four, different pieces of equipment you need to consider. The turntable and the speakers are the obvious ones, but the third can also become the fourth depending on your choices. That is to say, you need an amplifier of some sort, and this is often combined in the same unit as a receiver or a tuner. They can be sold as separate units, but many will cover both in one. We know what the turntable and speakers do, and the receiver or tuner is basically what it sounds like. It tunes radio stations, but it also serves as the device that switches from your turntable to the TV or iPod, CD player, tape deck, whatever. And in almost every case, the receiver and the tuner are one and the same. So for the purposes of our discussion, I'm going to use the terms interchangeably. Oh, and the amplifier. Well, I mean, that's exactly what it sounds like. Especially with a turntable, you need something to increase the volume so you can hear it. Hence, an amplifier. So, four pieces at the most. Well, technically five if you count each speaker individually, but let's not overcomplicate something that doesn't need to be. Back to the budget. Budget is key. Seriously. This is the most important decision you'll make in the entire process, and I cannot stress enough how important it is to actually adhere to your budget. Because once you see all the possible bells and whistles on stereos, this is what's going to keep you grounded to reality. In terms of how much you should spend, it's honestly up to you. While the sky's the limit, and trust me, the sky's the limit, we'll talk about that in a bit, on the high end of things, I've seen solid systems as low as $500 for everything included. Now, I know that's not peanuts, but consider just how much you're going to use this system on a daily basis. It's an investment. To be honest, if you're trying to do this for less than $500, you're probably better off getting a boombox type thing and ignoring the turntable element. I would suggest $500 as the minimum budget if you want to have a stereo system that will deliver an enjoyable listening experience as well as one that's going to last a long time. In case you're wondering, my current studio setup clocked in at well under $1,000, and almost every piece had to be purchased brand new due to a variety of reasons, and I'll get into those reasons as we go. So, we've got our budget, and now it's time to look at what's out there. Well, actually, you know what? Maybe not right away. There's a few more important things I want to note, the most important of which is the fact that you should not be afraid to buy used or vintage stereo gear. Especially if you're doing this on a smaller budget, used gear can really drive up the quality-to-cost ratio. I'm not saying you should grab that random amp your buddy has in his garage and it's been there for like 20 years and covered in dust, but actually, you know what? With a bit of money getting it properly serviced, that can actually be a solid pick. What I'm saying is, vintage gear is often built like a damn truck. Especially once you get into anything really built before 1985, it's extremely dependable, durable, and high quality. I say this from experience, as last fall, I replaced my tuner that was built in 1981, and it still worked great. I just needed some newer technology. And my current amp is the one I bought in probably about 1995. So don't think that everything needs to be sparkly and new, because it doesn't. In fact, I think that buying used or vintage gear is often the better option, as you have far more choices and you know the track record far better. That is to say, since you know it's been out longer, more people have used it, and you really know what you're getting. Buying a brand new tuner with all sorts of add-ons is awesome, don't get me wrong, but it can also be as problematic as any other new technology. The other great thing about vintage gear is how it looks, like literally how it looks. Old school gear often has these little touches in terms of the aesthetic that you just don't see anymore. And it's almost the art of vintage gear that's so much cooler than a handful of black electronic boxes with green digital screens. It can really give your system some personality and make it unique. Now, on the flip side, new gear gives you the most recent features. I mean, you're just not going to find Bluetooth or Ethernet type things on vintage gear. And new stuff also gives you service warranties and greater ease of repair if necessary. But see, that's actually one of the best things about building a stereo system piecemeal. You can mix and match new and vintage items together. This is a really easy way to make your budget work for you, knowing which parts, to you, are most important to have new. By that I mean, you can have a really cool vintage turntable, you know, maybe even one from someone in your family that's been around forever, and you can connect it to a brand new combination amp and tuner. They both have their advantages, and in 99.9% of cases, they're going to work perfectly together. Now, whether you're buying new gear or vintage, just make sure you're buying from someone with a good reputation. The internet can help in this vetting process, or, you know, find a local stereo store and check them out. So yeah, vintage is a great way to save some money and also give your stereo a personal feel. But also know that there's a lot of vintage stereo equipment out there that will completely blow your budget, especially when you get into the world of tube amps or really anything with tubes and certain brands, the prices can skyrocket. So know that just because it's vintage or used doesn't necessarily mean it's less expensive. Now, digging into the actual pieces here, as much as I want to get right into buying an awesome turntable, let's actually start at the core of the situation, the amp and the receiver. For the sake of keeping things simple, let's assume you're going to buy a combined unit. If you want to get separate pieces, there's nothing wrong at all with that, but it's going to increase your costs significantly. Regardless of which piece of the stereo we're talking about here, the key is research, 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 research. If you want to get yourself a stereo system that you're going to have for decades, it's not the sort of thing you want to buy on a whim. Take your time and get the exact things you want, and of course, within your budget. This is where the internet becomes your best friend, as you can cast a really wide net in terms of what's available, and you can also look at what the different reviews look like. Don't assume that just because everyone on Amazon says a piece of equipment sucks, that there's no reason to look further. Every website has their audience, and in this case, I'd take far more stock in the write-ups on places like Crutchfield or Reverb or Stereophile, Wirecutter, or even CNET. There are tons of other websites across the internet that can give you more than enough information, and spending time doing the research is the key to success here, trust me. So, the receiver or the tuner, the brains of the operation. This is where features like Bluetooth, internet radio, and other things are going to be built in, but one of the most important elements to check is just how many inputs it actually has. Consider beforehand what you want to feed into the stereo sound. Your TV, your iPod, your Xbox, your tape deck, whatever. Make sure you have a hard count on how many inputs you need, as this is far from a standard number on the tuners you'll research. Seriously, some may have as few as 2 or 3 inputs, where others can be nearly a dozen. In my situation, I've got my turntable, I have a CD player, I actually have a VCR running into it, believe it or not. I have a Blu-ray player, the television, so many different things, and this can really push your cost in one way or the other, and the last thing you want is for your brand new tuner to arrive, and you can't plug everything in. Really, I cannot stress this enough. Get your count on. Along with counting the inputs you need, think about which of the many possible features you might want. I mentioned, you know, internet-based stuff, but you might want a remote. Do you want a unit that doesn't have a screen? Do you want it to have multiple speaker inputs or the ability to have it control wireless speakers in another room? Really, if you want to have your stereo play through your entire house, that's going to start with the receiver. Or maybe you need specific size dimensions or a shape or who knows. Honestly, the more specifics you can start with, the quicker this process is going to go. But on the flip side, if you have no idea at all what you might want, use Google and see what's available. There's nothing at all wrong with starting from a completely open place, and in many ways, this can actually be a more exciting build process. Yeah, this should be exciting. Enjoy it. Have fun. Nailing down the receiver is just the best place to start, as that in many ways is going to dictate what's possible in the other pieces. Personally, I have an Onkyo brand receiver, and I am a huge fan of that company. My new tuner has Bluetooth for my phones and everything else to run direct into it, as well as things like Pandora and SiriusXM built into the head unit. The interface, it's a bit clunky, but I love having it all contained in one place. Now, for me, the next logical step is probably the most intimidating one, speakers. Before I even get into the details on speakers, have you ever wondered just how much you can pay for speakers? We're talking super top-of-the-line audiophile speakers. For a pair of what most people consider to be the best speakers on the market, how much do you think you'll have to shell out for a pair? How much do you think? Just take a guess. $1,000? $10,000? $50,000? Yeah, you're not even close. Most people, myself included, point to the company Wilson Audio for the best speakers on the planet, hands down. And their current top-of-the-line model is the Alexandria XLS loudspeaker. To get yourself a pair of these insanely awesome speakers, it's going to cost you, that's right, $200,000. Yep, you can buy a house, you could buy a Ferrari, you could buy 200,000 records from the dollar bin, or, you know, you could buy a pair of jaw-droppingly superb speakers. It's your choice. That's why we need a budget, right? Getting back to reality, you know, a reality where we're not considering six digits on speakers. Speakers come in pretty much every shape and size you can imagine, but the two basics are going to be floor standing or tower style and bookshelf speakers. The latter simply means they're smaller in size, but know that it in no way reflects the quality of output. You can get great bookshelf speakers that will give you all the volume and sonic range you can handle. Really, I actually have bookshelf speakers for my system here because I live in a small apartment in Brooklyn, and space is at a premium. Mine are actually made by Polk Audio, and I love them. Got a subwoofer with them too, but we'll get into why I got that in a little bit. But know that the bookshelf versus floor standing speakers is another very important decision in this process, as you need to figure out where you physically want your speakers to be, as well as the space that you have in that spot. If you have an entertainment center or a wall unit of sorts, the dimensions can really dictate what you're going to get, so make sure you consider the space before you dig in online. So now that we've got size handled, it's time to dig into the specifics of speakers, and it all starts with the actual cabinet design. The cabinet is basically the type of wood or plastic surrounding the actual speakers, and most people overlook the fact that this is a key component in overall sound quality. Now, there are basically two types of enclosures, acoustic suspension or bass reflex. Acoustic suspension speakers have a completely sealed enclosure. There's no holes in it anywhere. And this tends to provide a more accurate bass sound. Due to the way they're designed, this style of speaker often needs a more powerful amp to play at the same volume as their counterparts, the counterparts being bass reflex style speakers. And these tend to have an opening or some sort of vent on the back to extend the bass response. You can literally look at the back of the speaker and you'll see an open hole. They can get louder than acoustic suspension style, but the accuracy of low-end sounds is sacrificed for this. Know that both of these styles deliver outstanding sound, but many speaker companies are going to use one of these terms in the description, so I think it's important to understand that small difference. I'm going to gloss over the actual materials of the speaker drivers, you know, what they're made from, as they are endless in terms of configuration. As long as you're using a reputable company, you don't need to worry about this aspect much at all. But don't be surprised if you see them advertising everything from paper, plastic, rubber, metal, or even silk being part of the drivers. They're all good, so don't worry. So the last part of speaker buying could be the most confusing. It's all the numbers and ranges and terms like impedance, sensitivity, and frequency response. They're actually pretty simple concepts and can really help you feel confident in making your purchase. Let's start with impedance, as it's the most intimidating word in there. Impedance deals with the load value that the speakers present to the amplifier, and it's measured in ohms. In other words, it's the resistance that the speaker gives to the voltage or current coming from the amp. Okay, hold on. Let me see if I can come up with another way to define this, because I understand impedance, it doesn't really make sense. So, okay, you know what? I got it. Think of your speaker as a pipe. Any pipe will do. We're talking Mario Brothers pipes here, okay? And the audio signal, you know, music or whatever it is, that's the water flowing through the pipe. Now, the bigger the pipe, the more easily water can flow through it. At the same time, a huge pipe can handle a far larger volume of water. So with impedance, the lower the number basically means it's a larger pipe. So with that larger pipe, or lower impedance, the more electricity can flow through, giving you more volume. It's an inverse relationship between the impedance number and the achievable volume. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you always want the lowest impedance number possible, as many amps, in fact, most amps, can't work right with 4-ohm speakers. Those tend to be the lowest you're going to easily find, and they won't work because, well, you know what? Let's go back to that water idea. The amp is like a water pump, and most amps can't push enough water into a 4-ohm pipe to make it flow. I think that makes sense now. I think impedance now makes sense. I hope. Anyway, for home systems, whether they're going to be bookshelf or tower speakers, you're basically going to be dealing with either 6 or 8 ohm systems. If you're looking for something for the home and it's a 4-ohm system, it's going to be something that is serious audiophile quality, and it will absolutely need its own dedicated amp. The short version is almost every amp will have an ohm rating written on it, and it's going to be marked with a Greek omega symbol. So as long as the amp says it's good to go at 8 or 6 ohm systems, just go for it. In 99% of cases, impedance doesn't matter, but I think it's important to understand what impedance means. Moving on. Sensitivity. This is pretty simple. The sensitivity rating tells you how effectively the speaker turns power into volume. The higher the rating, the louder your speakers can get. Sensitivity is measured in decibels, and they almost always have a chart on the back telling you how many watts you're going to need from your amp. Lastly, frequency response. This is also exactly what it sounds like. It's telling you how much sonic range can be reproduced by those speakers. In most cases, numbers are going to be pretty much the same across different brands from one speaker to the next, but this is oftentimes where people are going to add in a subwoofer to compensate for low frequency sounds and bass. It's what I did. I just needed a little more of that low end. I like my funk and I like my bass to hit right. And especially with bookshelf style speakers, the mid and high range frequencies are really great, but the low end leaves much to be desired. I'm not saying there aren't great full range bookshelf speakers out there, but this is where, if possible, it's a huge advantage to go to stores and actually listen to the speaker sound in person. Now, you may also see different types of places for the actual speaker wiring to go in, the binding, with both spring clips and binding posts existing. I happen to prefer the post style. It's round and you can screw it in, because I find them to generally be sturdier. But this should not at all be a deal breaker if the speakers you like only have spring clip terminals. So yeah, speakers have a lot of possibilities, and with so many configurations, it's easy to find exactly what you want sound-wise and look-wise in the price range you're looking for. You know, within your budget. Remember your budget? Don't forget the budget. One final piece of the stereo setup that I want to touch on is, of course, turntables. Since the last few episodes have been all about vinyl, I want to dig into the world of record players, as there are some very, very cool choices out there. With turntables, it's often the idea of you get what you pay for, and I'm going to say this right now. Do not get those USB turntables. The sound quality is inferior, and the needle will ruin your records. Seriously, cheapo record players can do some major damage to vinyl, so be warned. Also, steer clear of those all-in-one setups. They're so far below low quality in terms of build and sound, and while they may look cool and convenient, trust me that they are so not worth it. The last quick note is to avoid one particular company, and I only say it because of the nightmare stories I constantly hear about their turntables. That company is Crossley. Their players usually look really cool and have a reasonable price, but they seem to destroy records and break easily. But that's just my opinion from what I hear all the time. Now, that's not saying you need to spend thousands on a record player, because you don't. And in many ways, choosing the player comes down to personal preference. Do you want something that looks a certain way? Maybe you want it really minimalist, or maybe really vintage, or a certain color, maybe you want pitch control. Who knows? Just give it a little bit of thought first. Now, the turntable is actually one of the places where you can save a ton of money, as used turntables can give your setup a great look, and, you know, like I said way back at the beginning, the build quality of older stuff is likely to be superior. Along with that, I cannot stress enough how important it is to try it before you buy it. Most stores that sell players will totally let you do this, and if you're buying used gear, 1000% try it. Play a song or two and make sure it works, but more importantly, make sure you like how it works. Not all turntables function or flow the same way, so make sure you give it a test spin. I'd also check the platter out, which is the plate that the record will sit on while it's playing. These are often removable, and as I see it, the heavier the better. Also, I'd make sure it has some sort of anti-skating mechanism, which will keep the needle from scratching the record in many cases. And this is often combined with an adjustable counterbalance system, some sort of weights or something like that. And if the record player happens to have a replaceable cartridge, which is basically the needle in the casing, you're golden. To be honest, if you're buying a new record player, I'd set aside $300, $400 minimum for this aspect. At least for me, it was the most important purchase, and if you want something to last and sound great, it's not going to be super cheap. A few turntable brands that I dig are Audio-Technica, Project, and Riga, the latter being what I personally use, the Riga P1, which I love. But that's not to say there aren't other great turntables out there, but those are the three brands that I fully support in terms of quality. Once you've got a turntable in mind, just jump into Google and read up on it as much as you can. Whether it's old or new, trust me that there's a ton of information out there, so you should never feel like you're buying blind when it comes to this piece of the stereo. And seriously, I cannot stress strongly enough, treat yourself to a record player. And maybe spend some time in the vinyl subreddit on Reddit. I'm there, and I can tell you firsthand, there are tons of great resources on buying your first turntable, and it's a solid place to get all of your other questions answered, and hey, you might even be able to buy some great used gear. Now, one last thing, cables. It is insane to me how expensive some people try to sell simple audio cables for these days. And then they try to defend the price with silly things like gold plating and other little points that don't actually matter. You can find out as much about cables as you can about components on the internet, but here's a quick rule of thumb. Do not buy monster brand cables. I don't like to slam any particular company, even though I have twice already today. Anyway, from my experience, I've never had any product that they sold outperform anything else, and they break quite often. For me, they might look pretty, but monster cables just aren't worth the extra expense. Whew, okay, that was a lot of information, but I will say this. Having a solid home stereo is one of the things I love most about my home, really. Most stereo setups will last decades and decades, so understand that this really is a long-term investment, but you can also pace this out over a number of months or years. You don't have to buy everything all at once. You know, maybe you upgrade your receiver now, and then in 6 months you save up and you get a record player, and then another 4 or 5 months after that you get your speakers. You can slowly build it and in the end still have an amazing stereo setup. That all being said though, as I said at the start, budget is key. With everything I just discussed, you probably get how quickly the price can spiral out of control. So before you even start looking, check your bank account and work with a realistic budget. Now, if you've got a great stereo setup now or you're building one, I want to see it. Hit me up on Twitter at @thedailyguru or at @getearfuel and send me a photo. I really, really want to see the great stereos out there. And obviously, if you have more specific questions, you can get me on Twitter or email me at getearfuel@gmail.com. Good luck with your building. Have fun with it. Seriously. And I hope this breakdown gives you more confidence in putting together a killer stereo setup. Now, before we wrap the episode, I do, of course, have your weekly Earfuel listening assignment. For those of you new to the podcast, each week I assign an album to listen to in full, beginning to end, without any distractions or interruptions. It stems from the fact that these days, music has been largely relegated to a background task. You're at the gym, you're driving, you're at work, whatever. And this assignment is all about taking some time each week to consciously listen to music for the sake of music alone. Now this week, since it happens to be one of my favorite records to test a new stereo setup with, your assignment is Led Zeppelin's unbelievable and unbeatable 1969 album, Led Zeppelin II. For my money, this is Zeppelin at their best. And while I love many moments from the rest of their catalog, beginning to end, Zeppelin II is my favorite. There's not a bad second anywhere on here. And along with being a turning point for the band, to me, this record is also one of the key moments in the development of heavy metal and maybe even a bit of punk rock. Now, before I even get to the actual music, Zeppelin II has a wild history in terms of recording, as it was done in pieces in more than half a dozen studios, and legend has it that almost the entire record was written during sound checks and after the live shows they were currently playing in support of their debut album. Furthermore, many of the iconic riffs you hear here were actually taken from random jams the band did on stage during those live shows. And the reason it was recorded in so many studios was because the band would get a great musical idea and just find the closest possible studio to get it on tape before they forgot or they lost the moment. I think that's why there's such a sense of urgency and power across this record. It's one of those albums that gets better the louder you play it. Trust me. The opening track, Whole Lotta Love. Oh, so good. I mean, not only is it iconic as a sound and as a riff, but the way they mixed it also set a new standard. As the story goes, guitarist Jimmy Page and engineer Eddie Kramer basically started messing with all of the different dials on the mixing console, and then they kept the parts that they liked. That's why the song has such a unique sense of movement, and this experimentation opened the door for countless other bands to make a trademark sound. So you've got Jimmy Page ripping iconic riffs on Heartbreaker and The Lemon Song and Livin' Lovin' Made. And once this record drops, Page had easily cemented his place as one of the greatest guitarists ever. You also have John Paul Jones on bass, the Forgotten Zeppelin, and he is ridiculously great on this album. If you follow the grooves he's creating, especially on What Is and What Should Never Be, I mean, please bring him up on the mix and give me those funky grooves. Of course, Zeppelin II is also the finest work of the greatest rock drummer ever. And this is fact, not opinion. John Bonham is the greatest rock drummer ever. He is. And Bonzo's in rare form on this record, from the full throttle performance on Heartbreaker to his almost jazzy take on What Is and What Should Never Be. And, well, I mean, you've heard Moby Dick, right? You gotta hear Moby Dick. That's raw talent if there ever was, and you just can't top Bonzo. Then there's Robert Frickin' Plant on vocals. You can argue that the entire spirit of Led Zeppelin comes from Robert, as he has a certain swagger in his sound that works brilliantly alongside his unmistakable voice. From the meditative sound on Thank You to the outright majesty of the album opener, Plant just destroys from beginning to end, and this is the epitome of a rock and roll frontman. I just can't hold back how much I adore this album. It's always been a top 10 favorite for me, as it represents everything there is to love about rock and roll. It's almost impossible to find any band since that hasn't taken a massive influence from Led Zeppelin, and they never sounded as locked in as a band as they did here. And if you have not blasted Zeppelin II from beginning to end in the last 48 hours, go do that right now. Thank me later. So that's all for this week, and we have now officially wrapped our four-part series on vinyl. Woohoo! Hope you had fun. As always, the podcast is available in the iTunes and Google Play stores, along with at GetEarFuel.com. And hey, if you like what we did here, go tell a friend or three. That is your weekly Ear Fuel. Share and enjoy.